Hello and welcome to the Answers for Cancers podcast. I am your host, Anne-Marie Fay.
And I'm Michelle Matthews.
Together with some of Ireland's leading experts, we want to unravel what it truly means to have cancer.
From consultant diagnosis to treatment plans, from managing your symptoms to supports available, we have it covered. So whether you're a nurse working in oncology or have been personally affected by cancer, this podcast is for you.
Yvonne O'Mara is a systemic psychotherapist and psychosocial oncologist. Yvonne has worked in the area of psychosocial oncology and palliative care since 2004 in teaching hospitals in Ireland and in North America. She has recently taken up a post at University College Dublin School of Medicine as Women's Cancer Survivorship Research Coordinator based in the Mater Hospital, and she also works in a private practice. Yvonne provides support and advice in talking to children right across the disease trajectory from newly diagnosed to palliation. As we say at the top of our episode, talking with Yvonne has really opened our eyes to the different relationships and the discussions that happen within those relationships when it comes to cancer. We learn so much and we hope you do too. Enjoy. So good morning, Yvonne. Welcome to the podcast. Thank you for taking the time out to come and speak with us today.
It's my absolute pleasure. It's a topic that's very close to my heart, so I'm delighted that it's being considered. Thank you.
Thank you. So we're really excited to open up this conversation on how to communicate to children about illness and cancer and death and dying. So we'll just get straight into it.
So thank you so much, Yvonne. So first of all, in your opinion, do you find parents struggle with talking to children about illness and in particular cancer?
It's a great question. I think when illness comes into the family, it throws the equilibrium, the balance off. And I think initially a parent wishes to protect the system and the previous status quo. And illness, of course, brings about a lot of change. So it's not uncommon for parents to take the position that they will conceal it for certainly initially, the initial periods, if not for longer. I've met parents that have concealed not one but two cancers from their children. So it takes a lot of strength to conceal, and an unnecessary amount of stress, I suppose, concealing a secret like that and adding to the burden not only of the disease that the person has, but also the fear that the child might find out from somebody else. So I would always ask a parent when I meet with them, what is it that they are fearful of? Like, what's the worst thing that could happen when they tell their child? And then I always invite them to think about their own family tree. I get them to reflect on their own experience of illness when they were little. What we do know statistically, that there's a 25% of those that have been diagnosed with a cancer diagnosis, that there's a child under the age of 18 within a household. And we also know that 4% of all cancer deaths, there is a child under the age of 18 within a family. So it's prevalent, and we need to really encourage parents to bring their children along the disease trajectory with them, whatever that trajectory is. And when I ask parents to think about their exposure to cancer, their exposure to death and dying when they were growing up, it's often very much their experience at that stage that is influencing them at this stage in the telling or not telling. And when you can unpack that and get a bit of perspective, what was it like to be included? Maybe you had a parent who died from cancer and it wasn't spoken about. How does that influence your position now? Maybe you had an aunt that died from, you weren't quite sure because it was never discussed. Again, how does that influence you now? It's not uncommon for me to meet parents who were sent away when a parent was sick. And while they understood the reasons why, it wasn't their benefit looking back in it retrospectively. And the parent that chooses to tell and the parent that chooses not to tell, they both love their child equally. And I think the common denominator is they want to protect the child. But what we do know is there's an overwhelming amount of evidence to suggest that protecting your child is including your child.
So Yvonne, can you give us a few benefits of why talking to your children about your diagnosis is important?
Great question. Yes, I absolutely can. I think as a parent, the biggest gift that we can give our children is that they can come to us about anything. And if we have a history of keeping things back from them, the chances are they will not come to us about events in their lives. And cancer is a significant event that we know impacts the entire family. So the biggest gift that we can do is educate our children around cancer. Cancer isn't a scary word for a three-year-old. We make it scary by not talking about it. So I would say the biggest benefit of talking is that you're setting a precedent for your child that they can come and talk to you about anything, or members of your family, that there's open communication. So if they feel that they want to talk to their granny, or if they feel they want to talk to their brother or their aunt, that there's permission for them to do so. Not having to watch what you and others have to say, that is so burdensome, as I've mentioned previously. It's really important that, that's not something extra that you're carrying around. It's enough being sick, let alone having to try and protect others within your family. Keeping a secret, as we know, is absolutely exhausting. And I think it's really important that we have faith in our child's ability to cope. So children can cope with anything as long as they have the structures in situ to support them. And their biggest structure is their parents or their guardians in their lives. So having faith in your child. Also, the benefits of talking not only to your children, but also to the community that your child is involved in. So the school, it's important to keep them in the loop regarding your diagnosis. It's important to keep, if your child is involved in particular sporting activities, it's just having extra people to have a lens to keep an eye out on your child. It just gives that sense of companionship for your child, that they know that people are looking out for them, and also for you to know that there's others when you perhaps are unwell, that actually somebody knows that this is going on in our world and they're keeping abreast of things in your child's life. And so it's what we do know is that you can't stop a child from feeling sad, and I think that's one of the biggest restrictive factors that inhibit parents from telling their children, because they don't want to upset their child. But it is upsetting, and as parents we have an obligation to educate our children not only on day-to-day activities of life, but actually on emotional development, and to tell them that it is sad and the reasons why it's sad, but equally to reassure them within that pathway. So it's a real opportunity to do that, but you can support them in their sadness and teach them simultaneously valuable life lessons. And you have complete control over that. You may not control the disease, but you completely control what you tell your child and then the way that you support them.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Absolutely. So Yvonne, how would you start a conversation with your child?
Yeah, it's a question I get asked a lot, actually. And sometimes when I'm involved with families, there's a, I suppose there's a longingness for some parents that an expert comes in. And I always would say to a parent that I'm not the expert on their child nor their family, that they are indeed the expert. And if you were to ask a child, who would they want to hear news from? A complete stranger in a room that they don't know, or around their kitchen table or in the car from a parent that knows and loves them? You can absolutely be assured that the answer would be they'd prefer to hear from your parent. So a lot of my work is supporting parents to support their children in this phase of their illness. So first of all, there's no easy way and not one size fits all, but I can talk you through a few of the, I suppose, what we've come to know and learn what works better for children when you're breaking bad news to them. Timing is everything. I think it's really important as a parent that you come to terms with your disease first before you start to discuss it with your children. So you have a good enough understanding as to what's going on, and in as much as anyone can predict what the disease pathway, so what type of treatment you may be having, or if you're not, if you don't have that pathway yet, what it might likely be. So it's okay to say I don't know, because nobody has all the answers, but it's important to have that in your head first before you talk. Really important, again, you're the expert on your child. You know them better than anybody, and get a comfort from that and get an assurance. What we do know is children are most likely to ask questions when we walk with them and when we're in cars. And the reason being is that there's not direct face-to-face or eye contact. So often this can be a very good place to start the conversation. And obviously it's very key to be gentle and to manage the pace. I'd always encourage patients to firstly, ask the child, what do they know? Have they noticed anything differently with mom or dad lately, or grandparents? Have they ever heard of the word cancer before? And if they have, what's the context that they've heard it in? And what's their understanding of the word? So getting a sense of what's going on in that child, you know, what's their understanding of the world? And then you can build from there. And you also get them to, I suppose you get an insight into their world. Sometimes it can be difficult because there's no pathway really for parents in how to do this, and there's often a lack of guidance around there. So I hope that people will, I suppose, know that they're not alone regarding the anxiety that they may have. But rest assured, what you're doing is you're deepening the relationship with your child by keeping them included. And I hope that that will become very apparent as soon as you've done it, because the child then immediately relaxes. I'm kept in the loop, and my mom and dad have assured me that they will continue to do it. So the child doesn't become the detective, and that's really important. When a child becomes a detective around illness and cancer, that's a problem. A child needs to be a detective about the outside world and why do trees grow and all those lovely things, but not when it comes to significant events within the home. You need to ask, is your child in the loop or are they out of the loop? And that's a really good basis to start your conversation. I suppose it's important to normalize their emotional responses. They'll be led by you. It's okay to be upset if you're talking about it, because it is upsetting. Mm-hmm. So again, you're teaching your child, okay, this is upsetting. So and mom is upset or dad's upset. So this is okay, I can be upset. Don't be surprised if they're not upset. Don't take it personal. Children, you know, emotional developments can be very different to an adult. If you've more than one child and there's different age groups, consider talking to them individually. So what we would say, maybe 7 and under, they could be done together. 7 and over, depending, maybe a 12-year-old might have a separate conversation to a 7-year-old, but that it's really important that you keep all of them aware that all of them know, so that the 4-year-old knows, but maybe in different language, and the 12-year-old knows. So you would never say a lump or a bump. You'd always use the word cancer, but you might explain it. It looks like a bump on the breast, or it looks like a lump on the prostate, or in my tummy, or wherever the cancer is, that you would clearly use the word cancer. You'd clearly describe what it is. And I'll give some resources at the end, some language that you can use. I suppose one, and then you might use a euphemism. So one of the ones that I might use is, say, for chemotherapy. Chemotherapy, the cancer is like a weed in mommy's body, and the chemotherapy is like weed killer. And if you're having radiotherapy, I might say, you know, sometimes when the sun is really strong, it can burn the grass or it can burn some of the weeds. So radiotherapy can act like that. It can burn the cancer, but it doesn't hurt mommy, or it might cause a little bit of pain, but it doesn't burn it in the same way that you imagine, you know. So making it child friendly, whatever your child is into, or maybe it might be the mechanics of a car, but you'll know that, because again, you're the expert when it comes to your children. It's really important to tell your child how your health will be affected. Children don't like change no more than adults do. So they're going to be saying, well, are you still going to bring me to soccer? Can I still go to hockey? Am I still going to be swimming? Like, how is this going to impact me? It's really important that the normal routine of the family is kept in play. And what we tend to find is that when illness comes into the family, children can be compensated by toys, gifts, being shipped off to friends, sleepovers. And that's unusual for a child who may not have been, that may not be their norm. What we do know is that children like boundaries, children like those to remain, and children like to feel safe and secure. So if you're doing something different outside of that all the time, so they're going to take away or takeouts, or that they're having a different type of normality, then that's inviting them to think differently in a way that while you think it might be benefiting them, actually it may not be to their benefit. So just really, treats are great, but don't overkill it. let them know, again, the treatment in language that they'll understand, and how it'll affect you. So if you're going to be fatigued, say, well, Mommy will be able to take you swimming maybe every second Tuesday, and Auntie Mary's going to take you the other Tuesdays because Mommy's going to rest because that's the day she's in hospital, et cetera, et cetera.
So Yvonne, what advice could you give for the developmental stages?
I suppose it's important at any stage that you reassure a child that it's not their fault. Sometimes children think that they've done something, or if there's been disharmony in the family beforehand, maybe their behaviour was bold, or that they think that they've caused the cancer for dad or mom or for grandparents. So it's important at all stages to reassure that it's nothing that they've done mm-hmm. that has brought the cancer about. And also that it's not contagious. I think children, again, at all stages, just need to be affirmed that, you know, you can't catch this, that cancer is not something that transfers from one to another. With regards developmental stages, you know, I would often meet with parents, and they, through no fault of their own, would tend to dismiss maybe the needs of the younger children in the family. Oh no, we haven't told them because they wouldn't understand or they wouldn't know. And if you think about developmental stages, from the moment we're born, we're growing, we're developing, we're observing, and even pre-verbal, we have learned so much about our world and our carers that forms and shapes who we are. So an infant from 0 to 2, if cancer comes into the world in their family, you know, it's really important that their needs consistently are met in the way that they were previously. So meeting their physical and emotional needs. And again, simple language, using the word cancer. So if Mommy's going to the hospital because of cancer, Mommy's sick and Mommy's going. So not to talk to your child, even though they can't talk back, because it's you again are creating a pathway of trust at the early stages. Really important that routine is kept for all children, but obviously particularly this age where you're sleep training, and that's not upset and upsettled, because that's the last thing you want is that to when you need your much needed rest. When we look at preschool children, the age of 3 to 5, they have a basic understanding of illness, but they also have this magical thinking. So that's when you can get the contagious notion that they've given it to you, or that maybe the fairies, or that there's something that they've done that they can't tell you because it's so bad, you know, how their minds race. So it's really important that you explain what the illness is, and again, affirming that it's nothing that they've done. There often can be a disconnect in what they say and what they feel. So they might say they're feeling very sad, but they're laughing the next minute, and that's very normal. So not to judge them with regards to their emotional responses. Children can revert back to more infantile stage. So your five-year-old, if she'd ever sucked her thumb or had milk in a bottle, she might revert back to looking for those type of comforts. And again, it's just nurturing the child, supporting the child within that. They might become afraid of the dark. They might have separation anxiety, sleep disturbance. They might have aggressive behaviour. Again, routine is key, assurances and keeping them in the loop. Make your child feel important and included. So key to this. I would always say to a parent as well, you know, words and communication is our language. I mean, a child would turn this podcast off. It's mm-hmm. boring to them. They're not going to listen to something. There's no pictures. There's nothing magical about what we're doing. There's nothing visual to this. But a child's lens is paper, it's crayons, it's drawing. And I would encourage you to ask your child, when you've maybe broken bad news to them, in maybe a week's time, ask them to draw a picture of their family and see how they draw a mom or a dad, the person who's sick. See how they're viewing their world. Draw a picture of their school. See, do they bring illness into the classroom? Just try to communicate in their language and see what comes up in that. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be over analytic, but it just allows us to see what's going on or how they view. Draw a picture of the hospital. What do they include or who do they include? Just mm-hmm. invites us into their lens in a really nice way of doing it. Children 6 to 12 years of age, so they have a more complex understanding of cancer and illness. So you can explain cancer in a more in-depth and detailed way, maybe talking about cells, and they often can be prone to misconceptions and may feel, again, responsible for the illness, maybe that their behaviour has led to you being sick, or you might have said, I'm so stressed, maybe a month before you were diagnosed, because of your behaviour. And they might then internalise that it's because you made mom stressed that mom has now got sick, or dad mm-hmm. has become unwell. Again, their behaviour may change. It may be sad. They may cry. They may worry about the well parent. Will that, if dad has got sick, will mum now get sick? So it's really important to provide assurances that there will be a really low risk of that happening. I suppose they might react differently to situations that ordinarily they would have reacted differently to. They might also reduce their activity in school. Their grades might become a little bit less. Again, you're the expert. So important that you keep a tab of what's going on with them, what the changes are happening, and communicate to those that are in their world. And then, as again, we can talk about support later on, but there's lots of support there to help you through this. It's really important that parents respond by providing appropriate reassurances, taking the time to listen, and by allowing this, you can help the child feel included in some way. Children can often go to the internet, and they can also trust older friends, and for all the very best intentions, but it's important that you create a pathway that they come back to you with the information, or often misinformation, that they've acquired. Mm-hmm. With regards teenagers, they're a more complicated group, and certainly they're a group that I find as a therapist, they're the ones that would least likely come to therapy. So I work with younger children, but this is a group that tend to not want to come in and meet somebody like me if they're struggling. They have a more adult understanding of illness in a similar way to us, but also it's a critical time in their development. So as a teenager, all you want to do is fit in, and your dad coming to collect you in the school with no hair makes you stand out. So it's about navigating and communicating with your child on what best to proceed, or how they want you, how visible they want you mm-hmm. with regards things like that, and normalizing those responses. Don't take it personal. Mm-hmm. You know, teenagers, they don't want to stand out for all the wrong reasons. So an illness can sometimes make them stand out for those reasons. So they just want to blend in. Their behavior, again, they may revert to risky behavior. Again, they may regress in school. They may have depression. And it's a really important, I suppose, to keep a tabs of this age group. Boundaries, again, are so important, so that they don't have that you're so consumed about managing the sick parent within the home that the children are allowed to just run a riot. That doesn't lead to anyone's benefit. So rules are so important for this, because it provides stability and security for the children. And again, just important that the conversation. So one of the issues that would come up is that they're not talking to me, that my children, that my teenage 16-year-old isn't coming to talk to me. The biggest gift, again, is that you can tell your teenage son or daughter that it doesn't matter what's on your mind, that you can come to me about anything. And I respect the fact that you're not coming to me, but I just want you to know, day or night, that you can come to me, and I'll always be there, and I'll be able to hold what it is that you come to me for. And you've laid the pathway then. If the child chooses to, no more than with any adult, you can't make somebody talk, and a mm-hmm. child is exactly so, respecting their position, but knowing that if they don't want to talk to the parent, that also there's support for them to talk to somebody else as well, that they know this. And that is providing, again, security and safety for them.
So often the elephant in the room is the conversation around death and dying. Have you any advice for parents on how to open up these conversations?
So firstly, I'm delighted that you're talking about this, because immediately that elephant becomes much smaller. What I find is that parents, when they attend talks about communicating about cancer, in fact, they're parents that are much further on in the disease trajectory, and that they have an incurable cancer that may lead to their death. And that's where they want the advice. That's where they want the guidance. And again, what I say to parents, like what I've discussed before, parents will want to hear, our children will want to hear from their parents around this news. Depending on what you've told them thus far about the cancer, it's important to pick up from there. Or maybe you've been given a cancer diagnosis that you know is not curable from the start, that it's something that you will live with or will behave quite chronically. It's important to be honest and to use language that is age appropriate to your children. I think it is one of the most difficult things that a parent can do is to tell them that they're dying from a cancer or any disease for that matter. And there's no easy way. Again, it's important that you yourself come to terms with it first, just that you have some sense. Ideally, just like communicating about a cancer diagnosis, it's preferable that you have both the person who's diagnosed with the cancer and the other parent, if it's a two-parent family, that both of them sit down with the child. And the message that you're sending is that both parents can cope with this and both parents can have a conversation with the child and that the child can come to the either of those parents. It's up to the child to decide which parent they want to come back with questions. Mm-hmm. But the message you're sending is that to the child is, oh, both mum and dad had this conversation with me and I can talk to both mum and dad about this. And it's the same with death and dying, because what will happen often with children is if a parent is dying, they can tend to detach a little bit from them and become closer to the parent that's not dying. And that's very normal, but it can equally be very hurtful for the parent that is dying. So just to normalise that for anybody who's going through that, that it's not uncommon, and how, as painful as that is, it's a child's way of protecting themselves. So sometimes just being aware of that, I hope that you can get comfort from that, that it's nothing about you. It's just about how children are. It's important, again, to understand the language around death and dying. Has there been death and dying in their family tree recently? And if it is, what's their understanding of it? Again, I would always ask parents to reflect back on their own childhood and to see what their understanding is and was of death and dying. What was their first introduction to death and dying? Did their parents include them? Did their parents exclude them? Were they allowed to go to funerals? Were they excluded from funerals? Again, how does that shape your position when you're going to talk to your own child about that? Really important to just have some insight into that. A children is heavily influenced by a parental's emotional response. So if a child is, if a parent is crying, a child will be picking up cues. So a child will either go, I'm going to cry to be in alliance with mom or dad, or they'll decide, you know what, I'm not going to cry because that might make them even more upset. Or maybe they don't feel like crying because they don't understand the magnitude. So there's a variety of reasons why they have different and similar emotional responses to us. Don't be afraid to say, I don't know. It is really important to use death and dying. It's all too common for people in media to use the word passed away, passing, journey, etc., etc. That's a very sketchy word for a child. You pass out a car and yet somebody's passed away. How do they do that? What do they do? So it's really important to use clear language that is universal, that is universally understood, and that there's no doubt for them to become detectives. It's very nice, the concept of, you know, I'm the brightest star in the sky. But again, that's a bit abstract for a child. It's important to say that dead means dead. And then whatever your belief system is, so if you believe in an afterworld, then that conversation can happen. But that dead means that you no longer have a heartbeat. Dead means you no longer, your brain no longer works in the way that it did. And then you explain your religious beliefs, if you have them or not. But to say that, you know, somebody's passing and they're going to be a bright light in the sky, that's too vague for a child.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we look back to child-friendly expressions. Having conversations like this are really emotionally draining. And again, our child's way of expressing is through crafts, sports, art, music and dance. So again, I try to tap into that and see where they're at regarding those activities and how the conversations that we've been having, how are they manifesting through that. Really important to set family goals. So if you have a life-limiting cancer, it's important that we all set goals. So be it short, long, medium, that it's important that the child is aware of these goals. And if they don't happen, that's okay. It's disappointing for everybody, but it gives people something to look forward to. It gives them a focus. So really key to talk about it. What children really want to know when death and dying comes into the family is, will they be okay? What will it feel like? And these are questions that I work with adults that are dying. These are questions that they ask. Yeah. What happens after death? And is it their fault again? It's important that you assure them that it's not their fault. They'll ask, will it happen to them too? And it's important to explain that everybody dies, but that it's really unlikely that they will die, that they will live a long life. The children can behave somewhat narcissistic in that they're going, well, who's going to look after me? Can I still go to such and such? So important to provide assurances around pathways, around their activities of daily living. They'll wonder what happens to the relationship. So when you die, where do you go and how can I talk to you? So it's important that you maybe come up with your own connection with your child. Because what I know is working with children post bereavement, the parent that has laid a pathway for them to connect with them in death and has spoken to them, that child does much better in their bereavement outcomes, as opposed to the parent who, no fault of their own, perhaps it was too much or just time wasn't on their side, that those children struggle more and that we have to investigate how can they connect with mom or dad or granny or granddad. So if you have the autonomy, and often there's a great saying by Colin Murray Parks, is one of those good things about cancer is that it allows families to prepare. But one of the sad things is that often families don't take the opportunity. So if you do have time and you do have a life-limiting cancer, really think hard about bringing your family along with it, because you then can guide what happens after your death. You can tell your child, you know, when you see a bird singing, that's mommy, or you can think of mommy in a way that makes that child connect, that they have continuing bonds. Not that the mom is bird, I apologize, but that they feel connected to mom. Or when you hear this song on the radio, know that I'll be thinking of you. So there's lots of pathways. You can do memory boxes, and you know there's nurses and there's social workers that will guide you through that in any cancer center in the country, that they will be able to support you. Something that's really simple, and I do a lot of it, and it's very, particularly if you've low energy, is I would do memory canvases. So a canvas, and you paint your hands on and you put them on the canvas, and that's a really lovely thing for a child to have. And maybe you're doing that all along in your household, but it's a really lovely thing for that child to have in the event of a parental death, that they did this with their parent during their lifetime, and that their parent was thinking of them enough to know that they would have it after their death. It just provides security. And as we know, bereavement now focuses much more on, we evolve, and so do children when it comes to a death in their lives, that at each phase there's a different relationship to the person that has died. And what we know is that we never fully overcome somebody dying, but what we do is that we create bonds, such as I've discussed, that allows us to connect to that person throughout our lifetime, and that term is continuing bonds, and that is what we now believe is a good bereavement outcome, that if you think of that person, you feel connected to them, that you have a trigger of a smell and that you feel connected. And I suppose those who have a life-limiting disease have a lot of autonomy over educating their children regarding that.
So there's often a lot of confusion about if children should go to funerals or not. What's your opinion on this?
Again, it's a question I get asked a lot. You know, if you asked a child whether they'd want to be included or excluded in a family event, the chances are they'd want to be included. And a funeral is a ritual, but it's also a family event and a really important family event. Again, it's an opportunity for the child to see how we grieve those that we love. It's an opportunity for the child to partake in a ritual, and that it can be part of their life story. So if they wanted to write a letter, if they wanted to draw a picture, that they put that in the coffin. It's really important to give a child a choice. So maybe they want to be, you know, one of the questions I might get is, you know, could they see the body? Would that be too traumatic? Yeah. And again, I'd invite you to think about the first time that you saw a dead body. Was there a discussion beforehand? Did somebody lead and hold your hand? Did somebody encourage you to touch the body? And that again will influence you or the parent, how you deal with this time. What we do know is information, sharing, telling a child what to expect, that the body will be cold, that the body will be X, Y, and Z, that's important to share to the child so they know, so they don't have a fear of it. Maybe you show the body to the child before the actual service, and that the child has had time to spend with their close family members in the funeral parlour or at home, depending on how you celebrate that person's life. But again, giving a child a choice. I would never force a child into doing something that they don't want. But generally, if you can provide assurances or making the child feel connected to the deceased person, that will allow them and support them through this phase. But I think it's really important with regards to life stories that children who are comfortable and who want to be included, that they absolutely should. We know that they do better. And those that feel scared or maybe worried, explore that. What is it that they feel scared about, and try to unpack that for them and provide assurances, and not to leave them in a place longer than they want, or that they become uncomfortable or distressed. But death is part of the ritual of life, and this is a way to educate the child around it, be it a very sad component of life, but something that again your child will look back on. As a therapist, I work predominantly with adults. And I've yet to meet an adult that has said to me, you know, I was really happy that I was excluded from my father's funeral when I was growing up. I was really happy that I didn't know that they were sick. I've met so many adults in front of me that say, this is what happened. I was excluded. It's left a real pain in my heart as a result. I didn't know what was going on. I completely understand why my parents made that decision, but if they had listened to me, they would have known that I would have wanted to be involved.
Yeah, absolutely.
Such a good point. Mm-hmm.
So Yvonne, what resources would you recommend then for patients?
I suppose firstly, in all cancer centres, there are social workers and nurse specialists who would be very expert with regards this area, communicating with children about cancer. So don't be afraid to ask for them. You know, we understand that it's a very difficult area. It's not a sign of weakness. It's a sign of strength. And there is services out there that can help you. So please tap into them. Don't suffer alone in something like this when we can help you. There's a number of websites that are very, very good. One of them is www.tellingkidsaboutcancer.com. We have the Irish Cancer Society, www.cancer.ie, and they have a very good booklet as well. You also have the resources of ARC, which run a CLIMB programme, and that's for children under the age of 12, that you can, in your children can be part of a programme whereby they can be educated around what cancer means. You also have another website, www.macmillan.org. And again, there's really useful tips and drawing on some of the things that I have discussed today. If you have a child that has an intellectual disability, everything that I have discussed today is applicable to them, but obviously age appropriate. So they may function at a much lower level, though they're 15. They may be functioning at a 5-year-old or a 7-year-old. You know that. So taper it to that age group. But there is a very, very good website that has lots of videos and supports within it. And that is www.breakingbadnews.org.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Yvonne. We really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today. This is fantastic.
My
Thanks, William. Thanks for listening to the Answers for Cancers podcast. Please share this podcast with anybody who you think it might help. Also, if you can like and subscribe, it lets people know we're here. You can alternatively contact us on Instagram at @theanswersforcancers_podcast. And if you have any questions on anything that we discussed today, please email us at theanswersforcancerspodcast@gmail.com, or you can DM us on Instagram.